Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Joanna. Well, it's a hard act to follow, I'll tell you. She made some of the points I was about to make, but that's all right. I won't hold you as long as I would have. Thank you for coming on such short notice. I just was at Yale, and the place was full. Yale. So, you know, I'm a Princetonian. What do you expect? When it comes to Yale, let me just start on this note. I think Joanna made the right ending here. This is, to use a cliche, this is a historic opportunity. We haven't had this opportunity for years to form a new political movement that has a very broad-gauged appeal. What really attracted me to the Green Party was how broad and deep its agenda is not, quote, just environment, although that's extremely important. It cuts right to the issues of labor, of consumer health and safety, of the distortion of our public budgets through military overspending, corporate welfare, to the preservation of a defense of its own people, known as the national jurisdiction, which shouldn't be usurped by WTO and NAFTA and other systems like that. And it increasingly is focusing on the tools of democracy. We can have all the rights on the statute books. We got to have tools. And I want to talk about some of this this evening. But I do want to dispel one myth here. And the question I'm always asked is, do I know that I may cost Al Gore the election? And to which I said, if that was at all of any concern to me, I never would have run as a candidate. Because you don't run you don't run to lose. You run to take as many votes as you can from all the other candidates, right? But here we are in October, and frightened liberals, and I've never met more frightened liberals than I've met this year, say with dread in their voice, do you know how bad George W. Bush is? And I say, compared to who? The man who fluctuates every day between being the great imposter and the great pretender, Al W. Gore? You know how you can tell how little difference there is? I know this will outrage some frightened liberals because they have their little list, which we'll get to in a moment. Make a list of all the departments and agencies of our federal government. Consider the growth of the permanent corporate government in Washington that I have and my colleagues have been fighting for years. They're represented by 22,000 full-time lobbyists. They're represented by 9,000 political action committees. There were 5,000 lobbyists in 1975 and 400 political action committees. They're represented by a Wall Street Washington shuttle where key figures become secretaries of Treasury and Commerce and other high government posts and in the Pentagon, and then after a few years of on-the-job training, they cycle back into higher positions in their corporations or trade associations. They represent 80% of the money in federal elections, corporate money. They pick and choose many of the nominees. They decide who they're going to oppose and who they're not going to oppose as a carrot stick factor over some of the better members of Congress in order to intimidate or inhibit them. And they basically want three things from Washington, these corporate lobbyists. They want poor or no enforcement of the laws against them, regulatory agencies, for example, Food and Drug, Auto Safety, FAA, OSHA, EPA. The second thing they want are government contracts and grants, hundreds of billions of dollars. And the third, what they want are subsidies. They want subsidies and immunization from liability for the harm and the looting and the plundering that they're engaged in. And so Washington is one giant accounts receivable for these corporate interests. And it doesn't really matter who is in the White House, whether it's a Gore or a Bush, except on the margins. You know, little idiosyncrasies that one president or another would have. Basically, Gore and Bush are frantically raising money from the same corporate interests in order to see who gets to live in the White House and take the marching orders from their corporate paymasters. That's what it's all about. Now, let's take the departments. Does anybody really think that the following departments will be different under one or the other? State Department, Defense Department, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, Department of Labor, GSA, Food and Drug Administration, you name it. There are little bits of differences in the Department of Interior, little bit of difference. The Republicans want to cut down all the forests in the national forest, and the Democrats want to grandfather all deals to cut down the trees in the forest. And in the area of EPA, a little bit of difference, nothing much to brag about, however. Better rhetoric. Now, this is where the beguiling factor comes in. Do the Democrats have better rhetoric than the Republicans? Yes. They speak differently, but do they do differently? And if they do differently, how much do they fight for the doing differently? That's the difference between them. I'll give you a simple example that probably you're not very concerned about. D.C. statehood, Washington, D.C. The people in D.C., the people in the District of Columbia, of course, have no vote for any representation in Congress. No senators, no representatives. The only capital of any country in the world that allows people to vote that does not have the right to vote for members of the legislature or parliament. For years, the Democratic Party has stood fair square behind D.C. statehood. For years, the Republican Party has stood against D.C. statehood. For years, the Republican Party has done everything possible to make sure nothing happens for D.C. statehood. And for years, the Democratic Party has done everything possible to make sure nothing happens in D.C. statehood. So how different are they really? Other than take your choice. Do you prefer a provocateur or an anesthetizer? Which one would organize you more? Would it be a sweet-talking snake charmer like William Jefferson Clinton? Or would it be someone like Secretary of Interior James Watt under Reagan, who managed to so provoke the environmental groups that many of them doubled and tripled their membership? And they got a backbone, which many of them don't have now because it's the anesthetizer. It's Al Gore saying, I'm for the environment. I'm for the people. They're for the powerful. If only words would have a biological effect, Al Gore would have a forked tongue and a Pinocchio nose. Let's take an area that some frightened liberals may say is really different. Civil rights. Now, there's a real distinction between the two parties. You know, I've been around quite a few years. I'm sick and tired of Democratic Party rhetoric on this. I'm sick and tired of these white liberals going into black churches and getting just in the right cadence as they give them that good old rock'em sock'em civil rights talk, huh? And then they leave and betray them day after day. They love to do that. They got it down, Al Gore and Bill Clinton. Do they love to speak in black churches? They love to use the language and the cadence. How disgustingly pontifical when they go back to their office and don't do a thing about 200,000 black kids who are poisoned by lead-based paint peeling off tenement walls. When they do nothing about skyrocketing, never-before-reached levels of child asthma due to incinerators and other pollution that is called environmental racism. 5 incinerators in Hartford. Guess where they are? You think they're in the shrubbered suburbs? No way. They don't do anything about child poverty except talk about it. And in fact, lately, they don't even talk about poverty. Al Gore's wind-up speech in Boston, he says, I'm going to represent middle-class families. Oh, middle-class, isn't that nice? Middle-class families. How about 47 million workers in this country? One out of every three. One out of every three American workers who do not make a living wage, who are not part of the middle class because they are not paid for their just work. They don't get just rewards for their just work. Let's take you back to 1968. Not at Columbia. That was one hot year at Columbia. 1968, let's say you're 1968 now, and somebody says to you, I got a crystal ball. The purchasing power value of the federal minimum wage in 1968 was $7.30. That's the purchasing power today. Was adjusted. Okay, that's what people were able to buy in purchasing power, the equivalent of $7.30 today. And someone told you that by the year 2000, the economy will have doubled in real terms per capita, in terms of output. And then asked you, what do you think the purchasing power of a federal minimum wage should be now? Would it be too radical to say it should be about $14.50? You know what it is? It's $5.15 today. You see how people are falling behind? And 10 million Americans are at minimum wage. 70% of them are not teenagers. And then tens of millions more, $6, $7, $8, Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King. And then they got to work longer hours. And more members of the family got to work for these low wages to try to make ends meet. And then they can't. And so they got to go into debt. And there's $6.2 trillion in consumer debt outstanding in our country during a boom economy. And the savings rate last month just dropped below zero. It's the lowest in the Western world. Other countries have 5, 10, 15% savings rate. Below zero. People are spending more than they're earning because they can't make ends meet. And they can't make ends meet because the very costs of going to work have skyrocketed. You've got to commute longer. Another used car. Another insurance policy. Another repair bill. More daycare expenses. Who's going to pay for grandmother who's sick and ailing? There isn't health insurance to cover the family, even though she may be on Medicare. It's a torment. It's frantic. It's the year 2000 AD. What are we doing? Who designed this economy other than greedy corporations who dominate our government? Whenever corporations are given too much power, the society suffers. They've got to be kept in their place. They've got to be given boundaries because that commercial instinct knows no boundaries other than what's imposed on it. Every major religion in the world, going back 2,000 years or more, has pointed out that one society after another should be careful about giving the mercantile interests, the commercial interests, too much power because it's so singularly driven with that monetized mind that's so highly motivated that when it collides with other value systems, justice, health, safety, democratic processes, respect for childhood, respect for future generations, due process, when it collides, it runs roughshod. It corrodes, it destroys, it undermines these value systems. That's why the Bible referred to mammon the way it did. These were not revealed truths, they were everyday experience. 2,000 or more years ago, still true today, and certainly bolstered by many of our forebears' wise observations. One being Justice of Supreme Court Louis Brandeis, 1941, put it very pithily. He said, quote, we can have a democratic society, or we can have the concentration of great wealth in the hands of the few. We cannot have both, end quote. It's even truer today. There's a greater concentration of power and wealth in fewer and fewer global corporate hands that are merging almost by the week into fewer and fewer giant corporate conglomerates that are astride the globe, unchallenged by any countervailing power, with governments as minions, deep in debt to IMF or World Bank or other chancellors of the exchequers in the Western world, and corporations that now command the labor, the capital, the technology and more governmental power. And not satisfied with controlling national governments, the architects of WTO and NAFTA have developed an international system of autocratic governance contrary to our due process, our open courts, our public dockets, and subordinating our proposed or existing health and safety standards to challenge by other countries who can say, your auto standards are too tough, your food labeling standards, your pesticide standards are too tough, you're restricting imports into your country from our country, and that is GATT or NAFTA illegal, and we're going to take you to Geneva, where the courts under the WTO are closed to everybody. There is no public transcript. There is no independent appeal. And if we lose, as we've lost 5 out of 5 challenges to our environmental regulations already, if we lose, we have to either repeal our law or regulation or pay economic fines to the winning country ad infinitum until we're in compliance. And why would we lose? Because WTO and NAFTA is an instrument of giant corporations to depress costs and to depress standards, which is the same thing. And in so doing, the countries that treat their people better are more vulnerable to challenges by countries that don't treat their people so well, accusing us of erecting these health and safety laws as a way of imposing non-tariff trade barriers on their exports to our country. Pretty interesting scheme, huh? When Clinton and Gore pushed this through Congress under a fast-track procedure, which meant no amendments allowed on the floor of the House and Senate, which meant limited debate. The House debated its pay raise in that period longer hours than it debated GATT. And under these autocratic procedures, it is not surprising that they produced autocratic systems of governance. And so we are losing on the installment plan more and more of our local, state, and national sovereignty. In fact, we gave up more of our local, state, and national sovereignty under NAFTA and GATT WTO than any legislation in American history. It wasn't that there was no opposition. Public opinion polls showed more against than for, and there was a global trade watch coalition of unions and environmental, consumer, church, human rights groups. They were not up to the combined power of the Clinton-Gore White House and the big business establishment. And so when you get this concentration of power, here's what happens. Number one, our expectation levels are controlled. You think you have high expectation levels as a young generation? You've got one of the most absurdly low expectation levels of any generation in history. Your main expectation level is to get a darn good job where you can be a law-abiding citizen and go through life essentially on your knees as long as you're remunerated for it. And if you don't believe it, look at the Columbia University graduates of 10, 20, 30 years ago. Ask, where are they now? Where are they now? Huh? You can't say, look, we all grow up corporate. If you grow up corporate, you grow up with low expectation levels. Let me give you a personal vignette. When I was a youngster, I prided myself in spotting the models of cars as they went by. I said, hey, this is a Chevrolet, this is a Pontiac. I had gone to the 1939 World's Fair here in New York City, and GM had the biggest exhibition. It was something like Futurama, it was called. And it had all kinds of different electric vehicles and turbine vehicles and all these things they projected in the future, which we still don't have from General Motors, by the way, as the internal combustion engine moves into its second century. And here I was, a little boy running to my parents, excited, shouting, GM, GM, GM. Little did they know at the time, of course. I would hitchhike to college and law school. I found transportation very dull, so I wanted a little excitement. You always learn something. Someone picked you up as a bricklayer or a tree surgeon or doctor, and you know, you got a lecture free. No interruptions, no cell phones in those days. And we would often come on to some pretty grisly accidents, crashes. Especially one I remember between Hartford and Boston, which was a ricochet multi-rear end type crash, and you couldn't believe the bloodshed, the moaning, the dying groans, and one little child virtually decapitated. And that got me interested in how cars crumpled in a crash, and I did a paper at Harvard Law School on it, which was turned into the book Unsafe at Any Speed. But what was most interesting is that my own evolution was, how could I have looked at cars the way General Motors wanted me to look at them? Answer, that's all the advertisements were. Auto company, that's how we looked at cars. We couldn't see what they could be like, because they were not advertised or reported in terms of what they could be like, in terms of fuel efficiency, pollution control, crashworthiness, and so on. As a result, it was a liberation. I was beginning to grow up civic, looking at cars the way they should be looked at, from a functional standpoint, on behalf of the interests of motorists, pedestrians, communities, and balanced transportation with public transit. So I it might be said I moved from growing up corporate to growing up civic. Now, you can test yourself very easily. When I use the following words, crime, violence, welfare, regulation, what comes into your mind? You've been programmed. It's street crime. It's war or violence in the streets. It is poor people lined up for welfare checks. And it's government regulation. Now, look at those words empirically. By any criteria, more people in this country are killed, injured, subject to disease by corporate crime and violence than street crime, bad as street crime are. Now, you might say, that's outrageous. Where is my evidence? Just look at 60 Minutes from time to time, 2020, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Business Week. It's all there. Nothing happens, though. The reports are there. 2 weeks ago, Business Week had a cover story, September 11th, Business Week, and the cover story was, too much corporate power? Question mark. And inside, page after devastating page of detail, showing that the answer of Business Week magazine, remember, these editors from Business Week do not read Karl Marx on their lunch break. The answer was yes. And the editorial accompanying this remarkable copy, although Business Week had done a lot of investigative reports on corporate abuses in the past, the editorial said, quote, corporations should get out of politics, end quote, the exact words. So Business Week magazine now is to the left of the Democratic Party. Far to the left of the Democratic Party. Let's run them through. 19,000 homicides last year, far too many, in the streets, etc., and homes and so on. 19,000, all right? 65,000 people die every year from air pollution, preventable. 100,000 people die every year from exposure to occupational hazards, particulates, toxics, and trauma. Most of it's preventable. 80,000 Americans die every year, according to the Harvard School of Public Health study, from gross malpractice in the hospitals. Preventable. How many are attributable to the tobacco drug lords? It takes two to produce that kind of result. The addictor, tobacco companies, and the addictees. And when the drug companies figure out that if they can hook 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, that they can hook them much more easily, aren't they for some of the 400,000 deaths from tobacco-related diseases? And how about the Delcon Shield, which was mutilating hundreds of thousands of women here and abroad? And the company knew about it and covered it up, along with its A.H. Robbins company, along with the Aetna insurance company that was its insurer. And then how about just theft of property? You think bank robbers take away loot? They're pikers. How about this? Just in terms of your health care dollar, 10% goes down the drain due to billing, fraud, and abuse. Just billing. This is even before they put the whites on, and the hospitals and all. This is billing, fraud, and abuse. That's $110 billion last year. General Accounting Office, U.S. Congress is the source. No, you keep going. Well, how about welfare? Poverty welfare is modest compared to corporate welfare. These guys really know how to do it. When they get on there, there's no five-year cutoff period. There are no accusations of reducing the will to work. These are the mineral companies who get your gold, molybdenum, copper, silver, free for $5 an acre. A Canadian company got $9 billion of our gold on federal land in Nevada a few years ago, went to Washington under the 1872 Mining Act. The government had to sell it for $30,000, $5 an acre. The pharmaceutical industries, who brag about their great innovation and how they have to charge you such high world-class prices because they plow so much back into research, they get a huge amount of the drugs free from the U.S. government. Government R&D, National Institutes of Health. You heard of Taxol? You heard of AZT? Your tax dollars developed those, tested them. Then they were given away under government policy to Bristol-Myers Squibb in the case of Taxol, who is now charging a woman with ovarian cancer $14,000 for 6 treatments. No price restraint imposed by the government? And if the woman couldn't pay, she goes on Medicaid and the taxpayer pays Bristol-Myers at the other end. No royalties back to the government. This year, Bristol-Myers will gross $1.1 billion revenue from Taxol, and it took $31 million of your tax dollars at the National Cancer Institute to discover and human test that drug, and it was given to Bristol-Myers. This goes on all the time, corporate welfare. Agribusiness, corporate welfare. You name it. I've just come out with a little book, Seven Stories Press, here in New York City, called Cutting Corporate Welfare. It is at least over $200 billion a year just at the federal level. Never mind at the city level, where tax dollars pour into building stadiums, ballparks, and arenas while schools, clinics, drinking water systems, and public transit systems starve for lack of repair. And corporate regulation? You ever hear of corporate regulation of your lives? Well, look, let me give you an example. You think the government regulates you compared to corporations? They could never come close. Who knows more about your personal lives, corporations or government? The corporations know about your credit card history, your buying, what you buy, what you don't buy, your medical records. They're moving into your genetic records, financial records, you name it. They have profiles on you. They credit you with a score. You've got a number. You know, you go into the credit card economy, you're credit scored. And if you don't score right, they don't sell you. Or they overcharge you. And it's a number. We're supposed to be a democracy. Nobody puts a number on us like that. Corporations do. They know more about your genetics and your personal privacy. It's just starting. And what do you think all that fine print is? Any law students here? Law students? Huh? There's a law student, huh? Well, let me tell you, there was a survey of law professors a few years ago, and the question was, do you read the fine print of those standard form contracts that you sign on the dotted line? And most of them said, of course not. Now, you know why? It's not because they didn't have a magnifying glass. It's not because they didn't understand the technical jargon. It's because they understood that even if they read it, they couldn't do anything about it. Because these companies are private legislatures. They basically set the standard form contract, and you take it or leave it. You sign on the dotted line. If you don't, you go across the street, and the same auto dealer with another logo company on its name, it presents the same auto dealer contract right in front of you. It's written by the same law firm, probably. Have some fun someday. Next time you go down to buy something, like from Sears or from an auto dealer, or you buy auto insurance or a landlord's lease, just ask them when they give you the standard form contract if you can sit down and read it. You know, give them tell them something like, your mommy and daddy always told you never to sign anything you didn't read. Right? And you sit down, and there are things you don't like. You know, you double the warranty here, cross out a paragraph there. Delete the binding arbitration provision which strips you of your right to go to court if you have a dispute with the bank or the insurance company. And you got it all ready, you initial it, you know, it's like you're taught to. And you bring it back to the salesperson and you say, here, sign on the dotted line, we got a deal. See what happens. And so we wrote a book once, an action manual for lemon owners, and we had a pro-consumer car purchasing agreement. And we urged people, and the next time they buy a car, they go down to the dealer. And when they pick out the car, they slap this down and say, sign it online. Fellow writes us, he said, you know, I did exactly what you said. I went down to the dealer, picked out a car. The dealer was shuffling the papers and trying to, you know, get all the things that I was supposed to sign. I said, excuse me, I think.